The Debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. In Iran, lawmakers have given the green light to a plan to address the legal sanctions imposed on the country. Iranian parliamentarians want the Rouhani administration to produce 120 kilos of uranium at 20% purity level and also make use of advanced centrifuges, among other things. Well, some analysts regard this as the first reaction to the Friday assassination of an outstanding Iranian nuclear scientist. The Iranian parliament speaker has stressed the move signals the end of the one-sided game as regards the Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA.
Iran's parliament or majlis has endorsed a bill titled Strategic Action to Remove Sanctions and Protect the Rights of the Iranian Nation. The legislation, which still requires the endorsement of Iran's Guardian Council, is aimed at tackling U.S.-imposed sanctions against the country. The bill obliges the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to produce uranium enriched at 20% purity for peaceful purposes and store inside the country at least 120 kilograms of the product annually. The bill also mandates the installation and operation of advanced IR-2M and IR-6 centrifuges. Furthermore, it calls for a metallic uranium production plant to be put into operation in the central city of Isfahan. The Iranian lawmakers have also demanded the optimization and relaunching of Arak's heavy water reactor and the designing of another such facility. The bill also stipulates that Iran will withdraw from the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty if the remaining parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal do not fully comply with their obligations and restrictions against Iran's trade continue to remain in place. The bill comes after repeated complaints by Iran that is not reaping the fruits of the nuclear agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, while it's remained committed to the agreement.
Truth of the matter again is that the key point of concern was a serious lack of commitment by the West, either in the United States or the European Union, that resulted in new courses of action taken by Iran.
Under the deal, Iran imposed restrictions on its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. However, U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Despite the U.S. move, Tehran remained fully compliant with the JCPOA for an entire year. But amid the failure of the remaining signatories to deliver the benefits of the deal to Iran, the country began a gradual suspension of its commitments. The timing of the approval of the bill is also noteworthy as it comes just days after the assassination of prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh near Tehran. In fact, an informed source has told Press TV that the bill is indeed Iran's first practical response to the assassination. Fakhrizadeh's killing is the latest in a long line of assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists blamed on Israel. Iran has vowed revenge, and judging by the swiftness and decisiveness of the parliament bill, the culprits and masterminds of the killing should be on tenterhooks.
Now, without much further ado, let's get to the point and start the show. Joining me will be peace and justice activists and analysts Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi from the Iranian city of Qom, and writer and political commentator Shabir Hassan Ali, who's joining us out of Leicester. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Welcome. Let's go to Iranian city of Qom. The Iranian parliament argues, Sarbaz, that enough is enough and that the one-sided compliance with a nuclear deal should come to an end. Let's have your comment on that.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I think what the Iranian parliament did was actually, as it was mentioned, the first solid step as a reaction to the assassination that took place on Friday, in which prominent Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was, martyred. A couple of hours after the assassination, there was a statement on behalf of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei, where it was mentioned, 2 points were highlighted in that statement. The first point was that there should be a retaliation, there should be a revenge to anyone who has done this deal act. Second was the path and the move and the, you know, the process that Dr. Fakhrizadeh was following should be followed. It should not be stopped and it should be pursued again. And the decision that took place today, the decision of the Iranian parliament, was actually a response to that, because decision of Iranian parliament today is actually paving the path for development of the Iranian nuclear technology for its peaceful goals. And it is actually because there were restrictions after JCPOA, when Iranians admitted to sign JCPOA, naturally speaking, there were sort of restrictions on the development of the Iranian nuclear facilities, Iranian nuclear science, and those who were the systems that were working on the nuclear technology and development of Iran. So now, by this act of the Iranian parliament, the, you know, problems, the obstacles in front of this progress is actually removed. So this means that the process and the goal that the prominent Iranian, you know, scientist Fakhrizadeh was looking after, was, you know, working for, that is now in a better, you know, condition. Those who are working in this field of technology will now actually find, you know, a better environment in front of them to follow their researches. And this is the biggest response on behalf of the Iranians to the Zionist regime. You know, it was mentioned that, analytically speaking, all evidences are showing that behind this act of assassination is the Zionist regime. So the decision of the Iranian parliament, which was on its proper time, actually showed that Iran has the will for continuation of the path that someone like Dr. Fakhrizadeh was following.
Okay.
And I hope that this is actually a game-changing decision by the Iranian parliament.
Right. Now, turning to Lester, Shabir, Iranian legislators want the sanctions lifted as soon as possible. Is this too much to ask them for, more than 2.5 years after the U.S. pull out from the deal and the reimposition of sanctions?
I think, first of all, I'd like to extend condolences to the Supreme Leader and to yourself and to all of the Iranians on the martyrdom of Dr. Fakhrizadeh. In terms of the sanctions, I think really Iran needs to get a grip now. This idea of sanctions, they're not going away. Whether Iran cuts down its nuclear program, or whether Iran does, you know, whatever, the sanctions are not going away until and unless Iran gives up being an Islamic revolutionary country. That's what they want. I was just watching a clip from an interview given by the pick by the Biden administration for the National Security Advisor. Mm-hmm. And you could almost remove his face and put Pompeo's face, and he was saying the same thing. The key points they have a problem with is Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's, as they say, support for terrorism, which is support for Ansarullah, support for Hezbollah, support for Hamas, support for the resistance axis. This is what they want. As long as Iran is doing this, I think we need to be very clear, the sanctions from America, at least, and Europe are not going anywhere. But on that note, Iran doesn't need America or EU. Iran has allies like Russia, like China, like other countries, the BRICS nations. And Iran can build things itself. Iran is a very strong country. It's a country that's been around far longer than America and Europe put together. Iran shouldn't be bending the knee and acting weak in front of these. I think the move that they made today in Parliament is brilliant, but long overdue. They should do it. They should have done it earlier. They should have never signed this capitulation agreement called JCPOA. Because this agreement, I don't know if any people remember, the moment it was signed in 2015, it was signed, the UN sanctions were removed, and US sanctions were applied by Obama, who everyone said was a saint and was so wonderful.
Right.
These people are all the same. They're all criminals. And Iran needs to, like, strengthen itself and listen to what Imam Khamenei is saying. That the days of sanctions, halas, make the sanctions irrelevant. Change the system, change the way they operate, remove the impact of these sanctions. The sanctions are irrelevant. They hurt America and other countries far more than they hurt Iran, if Iran strengthens itself and does its reliance on God like it did before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarbaz Observer is saying that the parliament plan is actually Iran's first reaction to the assassination of its eminent nuclear scientists. What's Tel Aviv trying to accomplish by virtue of this state terrorism launching against Iran?
You know, look behind you the history of Zionist regime. You will find that this is the regime that initiated its life with terror. They started, you know, grabbing the land of Palestinians by terror groups of Haganah and blah, 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 other groups who were entering the villages and, you know, beheading the people and, you know, spreading this violence and this terror in the villages to grab the land of the Palestinians. Later on, if you follow the, you know, the dynamic between this regime and other Arab countries, we see that when Egypt in the 50s tried to, you know, develop its ballistic missiles by the use of a group of the German scientists who were shifted to Cairo to help the Egyptians during the time of Jamal Abdel Nasser to develop their ballistic missile technology, Israel started its acts of terror, and those, you know, German scientists were one by one assassinated. And it was the process resulted in a stop, and all those, you know, German team, they left the they left Egypt because they were feeling there are, you know, terror attacks, you know, threatening them. Later on in the 80s, the same thing took place to Iraq, when the regime of Iraq, Saddam at that time, was looking after developing some nuclear weapons by the help of the some of you know, European countries such as France. Again, the same series of the terror acts took place. The same thing took place against against Syria in 2007-2006. But don't forget, this is the reality. I mean, the terror is the reality of the Zionist regime. They are alive, so-called alive nowadays, because of their terror policy. But this terror policy is not going to work against Iran. Iran is not Iraq. Iran even is not Egypt. You know, there are differences between Iran and other countries. And even if Israel is going to stop the process of development of Iran by the use of these terror strategies, it's very clear that they are going to defeat. Because what they did, you know, if you look behind these 10 years of the history, 10, 15 years of histories of these terrors, you should know that the terror process of the Iranian scientists, nuclear scientists, did not start at 2010. It started at 2007 when Dr. Ardeshir Hossein Pour, as the first Iranian nuclear scientist who was assassinated, actually there was, you know, still their analysis going on, but he was poisoned by gas, and most possibly it was done by Mossad in 2007, later on in 2010, Dr. Ali Mohammadi, 2011, 12. But one important point is that you should remember that the father of the Iranians' missile technology, Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam, General Tehrani Mokaddam, who was, you know, martyred in 2011, was known to be as the father of Iranian missile technology. There are also some, you know, some analysis telling that that event that took place in which Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam was martyred, it was also a sabotage, you know, act of the Zionist regime as well.
Right.
But within eight years, from 2011, when Shahid Tehrani Mokaddam, the father of the Iranian missile technology, was martyred in Tehran, within 8 years, the Iranian missiles hit the American base in Ain al-Assad in Iraq in 2019. So the elimination, the physical elimination of the Iranian scientists and Iranian prominent figures by the terrorist acts of the Zionist regime is not going to work, as it did not work related to the Iranian, you know, missile technology. The same is going to take place. And after this, as I mentioned, after the act, after the decision of the Iranian parliament, it's very clear. It's a system.
Right.
It's not a matter of a few people here and there that you eliminate them and you will stop the process. Stop the process. That's not going to work.
Now, Shabir, some observers argued that this recent assassination of the Iranian scientists was meant to hinder diplomacy with Iran. Are you of the same opinion?
I think what the Netanyahu's and Trumps of the world, the less diplomatic terrorists, if you like, what they wanted was to create a situation where Iran does a knee-jerk reaction to this starts a war in Halas. And so, yes, they are scared of the nuclear deal, the dead nuclear deal, somehow coming back, because it's very strange. Look, Mossad, CIA, all of these people, they know that this nuclear deal is not anything to do with Iran's nuclear power, ambitions and work. The entire thing is about Iran's support for the resistance axis and Iran's ballistic missile program and defense program, and its alliance with Russia and China and so on. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to do with the nuclear program. The nuclear program is, everyone knows, this has been proven time and time again, even by the CIA, by NSA, by Mossad, all of them know this. You know, it's just the media that keeps saying nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons. They know that Imam Khamenei has said nuclear weapons are prohibited. So they will keep on trying to do this. Now, the reason for the deal, why these people don't like the deal, is because, as far as they see, it alleviated, in quotes, some sanctions. And yes, maybe alleviated one or two types of sanctions, maybe. But the reality is, it's more psychological. They don't want someone to come and do a deal with Iran again. Mm-hmm. And in a way, a deal with America, anyone who has studied the history of deals that America has made with Iran or with anyone else, you cannot make a deal with America. First of all, America is an infantile country. It's a country whose administration and as an entity, it's less than 300 years old, of which 240 or 250 of those years, it's been in a state of war. It's never had a chance to mature. America is not capable of negotiating fairly and honorably with anyone, even its own neighbors. I mean, this is just like the situation we have in the UK, where the UK is unable to negotiate with even its neighbors for a deal. This negotiation talk, it's a placebo. It doesn't really solve anything. Mm-hmm. The reality is, what they want is they want Iran to abandon its ballistic missile program that Sarbaz Ruhullah just spoke about, from that was headed up by Aghay Tehrani Muqaddam, Marta Tehrani Muqaddam. And they want Iran to stop its support of the resistance axis, and especially of the Palestinians. If Iran was to do this, then they will negotiate and they will throw money into Iran. They will make Iran everything. You know, they will make Iran a heaven on earth in terms of the Western and the materialist eyes. But Iran will betray the revolution and the blood of the thousands, hundreds of thousands that died in making the victory of the revolution and the 8-year imposed war and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. If Iran was to do that, and Iran won't. Iran won't. Iran is a resilient country. It's wise. It's intelligent. And I know many people have been talking about, oh, what's Iran's response going to be? I think, like you have said, and the other guest has said, this response by Parliament is one tiny element of it. And the enemy needs to understand that Iran is not a country that will just knee-jerk into anything. Iran will take its time. At the end of the day, one of the key things that Iran manufactures are Persian carpets. And Persian carpets take years to manufacture. Anyone who knows anything about them knows. So Iran has got plenty of patience. But one thing we need to be wary about and be careful about is the Zionists creating a false flag attack in somewhere like the Emirates or somewhere in that region, mm-hmm. blaming it on Iran and using that as a pretext. And I think Dr. Khoshash had spoken about that earlier on, or had written about it earlier on, which people can find online.
Okay. Now, Sabah Zurala, the European side of JCPOA has only given lip service, as you know, and insisted the deal must be protected. Yet in practice, they haven't done much to allow Iran to benefit economically, as per the agreement. You know, banking operations, business transactions have been blocked. Sale of crude is facing obstruction. What's Europe waiting for?
I think Europe has proven to be, you know, a puppet of the Americans, and they are highly dependent on the policies of America. So when there is a change of policies in the United States of America, and there's a change of the administration over there, Europe is also changing its stand. So it's exactly the case that you mentioned, that there's nothing beyond lip servicing on behalf of the Europeans. They were not even able to solve the simple issue of SWIFT and the simple issue of banking between Iran and the European community, which was so-called independent from the American side of the story. from the United States side of the story. You know, they were not that involved, but even Europeans were not able to solve that banking process between Iran, because they are so-called, you know, with JCPOA. They even, you know, by their statements, they condemn the act of terror against Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. They all condemn it. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the reality on the ground, nothing is taking place, and it's all because, you know, unfortunately, still they are, you know, obedient. They are, you know, followers and puppets of the Americans as well as the Zionists, because of the pressures of the lobbies, Zionist lobbies over there, as well as the mm-hmm. dependency of the European countries towards the United States of America, unfortunately.
So if you
so everything is related to the...
Yeah, we have only 1 minute left. If I could put a last question to Shabir. Shabir, what do you anticipate will be the fate of the JCPOA at the threshold of a new administration assuming power at the White House? 1 minute, please.
I think JCPOA is dead. It was dead at the beginning when it was signed. It is dead now. And I think the people that still think it's alive need to accept that it's dead. The Trump administration, Biden administration, Republican, Democrat, makes no difference. They are the same. And, you know, those people who worked very hard for JCPOA, you know, inshallah, they will be rewarded. They need to sit down, you know, maybe go through the grieving process, do a fatiha, as we do when someone passes away, and realize that there is no deal with the U.S. or with the Western powers until they treat Iran as an equal. If they don't, then they can go to hell.
Okay, so it's like flogging dead horse, in your opinion. Thank you very much
for
your comments and contribution. We had peace and justice activist and analyst Sabaz Ruhollah Rezi from Qom, and writer and political commentator Shabir Hassan Ali, who joined us out of Leicester. Up in your host, Behrouz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Are going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini. The son of Ayatollah Ha'iri, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'iri, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, we are talking about the prayers, in fact, from the last part of our previous episode, and something left off, let me pick up from there. If a person travels somewhere, but he fails to offer the prayer within the time frame, and he misses his or her prayers, yeah. And then he goes back home to his own hometown. The question is, does he have to or does she have to offer the shortened form of the prayers? Of course, depending on, for example, whether he or she intended to stay in that place where she or he traveled to for a about less than 10 days or not. For example, for this scenario, what happens? What are they supposed to do? Do they have to offer the prayers as ghaza, all right, in shortened form or in complete forms?
And when you use the term traveler, we usually understand that a traveler has to offer shortened prayers.
Yes.
Yes. If someone is staying there, mm-hmm. he is no longer deemed to be a traveler. He is he's considered a resident of that area. Mm-hmm. And so a person who misses, or who happens to miss his prayers while on a journey,
right,
and he fails to give the qadha on the same day, because if he is going to give the qadha on the same day while he is still on a journey, he has to give the qadha in the short form, okay? He has to perform qasr prayers.
Yes.
And now the question is, the supposition is that the same person goes back home and he returned to his hometown. Of course, there's no doubt as to the fact that the same person has to redo and repeat those missed prayers in the short form.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he has to offer those prayers as they were missed. Mm-hmm. If they were missed as qasr, he has to offer them as qasr.
I see.
And if they were missed as full, he has to offer them as full.
Of course, we are talking about normal trips, normal journey, trips.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Of course, there are different, you know, situations, different scenarios in which a person, even if a person, maybe let's say, let's also note that a person may be a traveler, but he is still, according to Sharia, he has to offer full prayers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, if a person
such as Mecca, for example, right? Going to Mecca, being a haji.
No, that's something else, you know? You know,
like you have to actually offer the full form full of prayers, the prayers, right?
No, it's not mandatory to offer full prayers in Mecca or in Medina.
Or in Karbala sometimes.
In Kufa or in the closed premises of the holy shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. It is optional.
Uh-huh.
It's not mandatory to offer full prayers in those cities. And you have the option to either offer full prayer, offer full prayers or shortened prayers. It depends on you. But there are other cases. For example, if a person is traveling to a city and intending to commit a major sin, and he has that intention from the very beginning to go and do something, for example, which is a grave sin, he has to offer full prayers.
Yes, as qaza.
As qaza, or maybe even on the journey when he is on a journey, and his journey is in progress.
Right.
Has to offer full prayers, and if he misses his prayers again, he has to come back home, and of course he has to offer full prayers.
Yes.
In that scenario.
Uh-huh.
There are many, many suppositions. I think we have dealt with this issue in the past, and we need not to repeat.
Thank you very much.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Another question is pretty common among the folks with children.
Yes.
You know, we see this incidence going on, like it's pretty common, as I said, that sometimes it happens that the person is, in fact, saying the prayer, and while they are doing so, their children comes close and, they come close and take away the torba and the muhr. Right?
Yes.
Away from the person who's offering the prayer. So what are they supposed to do? Do they have to break the prayer or do what?
Of course, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that a person has to look for something, if there is something which is allowable for sajda, he has to do sajda on it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if he has a piece of paper in his pocket,
right,
he can take it out and do sajda on that piece of paper, assuming that that paper is generally made of wood. Okay, paper
True.
Is made of wood,
which comes from
it's
the
earth.
It's
not made of plastic or minerals or things like that.
Right.
And if he does not have any access to it, and there is nothing on which he could do sajda, he has to leave the prayer and look for something. He has to go and get something on which he can do sajda. Because doing sajda on carpet, on things which are deemed as clothes, is not permissible. Doing sajda on minerals is not permissible. Like, for example, if you have a ring, you cannot do sajda on that ring. You cannot do sajda on plastic or things which are either edible, like food items, or things which you wear, you cannot do sajda on clothing, and you cannot do sajda on minerals. Like, for example, if you have a piece of iron in your pocket or something, you cannot do sajda on it. Now, if
by mineral, what do you mean?
Minerals.
Like stones could be part of the minerals.
No, minerals, we mean metals. Okay,
uh-huh.
Like, for
uh-huh,
example,
metals,
silver.
I see.
Silver, gold, copper. These
right.
things are minerals, okay? And also coal.
Yes.
Charcoal.
Yes.
You cannot do sajda on it. But okay, stones, we have stones. and they are not in common sense, they are not called minerals.
What about marbles?
Marbles, of course, is permissible. You can do sajda on tiles, you can do sajda on marbles, you can do sajda on slates, stone slates,
yes,
cut into triangular, you see, square sizes, you see. Mm-hmm.
What about mosaics?
Yeah, of course, it's permissible. And you know, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if you cannot find anything on which you can search that, if you have a piece of clothing which is made of cotton, mm-hmm, pure cotton,
yes,
pure cotton, you can do such that on it. That's the lost thing.
Pretty hard to find nowadays.
Yeah. Cotton, yes, pure cotton.
It's pure. I'm saying it's pretty hard to find one nowadays.
Okay. Maybe
usually there's something involved, like nylon, for example, which is mixed with it, or plastic.
Maybe. That's just a possibility, a scenario.
Right.
If you have, for example, if you're wearing, let's say, a Pakistani, let's say, shirt, which is very long,
yes,
it's called something like gown.
Like a gown. Or a robe.
Yeah, or a robe, yes. And it is made of cotton. You can just do sajda on it because cotton comes from the nature.
Right.
And of course, it comes from plants.
Yes.
And there's no objection.
What if you're not what material has been used
that
in
is,
it?
That is, of course, you assume that it is made of cotton and you are, that is taken into account, that's taken into consideration.
Right.
And the presumption is there. In the absence of all of these things,
yes,
if none of these things is available or accessible, Ayatollah Khamenei says that you can do sajda on the back of your hand.
Oh,
yes,
I see.
Unfortunately, a lot of people take it as a license at doing sajda on the back of their hand when they do not look for turba, for leaves of trees, or for a piece of wood or a piece of stone, while these things are available everywhere and easily available, okay?
Yes.
And they quickly, you see, start doing sajda on the back of their hand, but that is absolutely not permissible,
mm-hmm,
because you can find those things. You can find a piece of stone. You can remove the carpet and do sajda on cement.
Yes. Right.
You can do sajda on the tiles. So in the present, in the existence of these things,
uh-huh,
it is absolutely not permissible to do sajda on the back of your hand.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
At the beginning of 2020, as COVID-19 began to spread from China and around the world, health workers and aid agencies predicted that the virus's impact on Yemen's vulnerable population would be catastrophic, forecasting a 90% infection rate. Yet despite its utter affliction so far, the war-torn country appears to have emerged relatively unscathed by the pandemic, reporting just 2,124 cases and 611 deaths to date. Testing facilities and comprehensive data are almost non-existent, so it is highly unlikely the official statistics reflect the coronavirus true impacts. But according to several doctors and healthcare officials in central province of Shabwa, at least the virus is not a pressing concern. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Bethan Makranan under the heading, Yemen in a country stalked by disease, COVID barely registers. This article was published on the Guardian.com website. Please stay tuned. On a ward in Atong General Hospital in the dusty central province of Shabwa in Yemen, 6-month-old Mona Bassam is lying on her back, eyes closed, her distended belly moving up and down with the labor of breathing. In the corridor outside her room, a poster shows before and after photos of several children admitted to the ward who have managed to recover from acute malnutrition, still painfully thin but smiling and alert. Mona's family have already taken her to hospital once before, worried about being able to pay for her treatment and fuel to return to the village. Their prayers for her this time around are even more urgent. The baby's grandfather, Abdullah, said, "My wife and I had 20 children. 11 of them died," adding, "But that was a long time ago. This should not still be happening today." Elsewhere, in the overwhelmed hospital, children are suffering with cholera, diphtheria, and dengue fever, contagious diseases that have stalked Yemen since the outbreak of war 6 years ago. For patients and doctors in Yemen in what the UN says is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, coronavirus barely registers. Dr. Ali Nasser Said, the hospital director, says, "We don't have a neurosurgeon. We don't have a maternity ward. We treat 20 children a month for malnutrition, and now we are admitting more and more people severely ill with complications from dengue fever. More than 3,000 cases so far this year. The generator doesn't always keep the equipment on," adding, "Coronavirus is nowhere near our biggest problem." Shabwa, an oil-rich region, has been firmly under the control of government-loyal forces since last summer. The province is relatively wealthy and stable compared with other areas of the country, leading Yemenis displaced by the fighting or migrant workers sent home from Saudi Arabia to settle here. As a result, Shabwa's population has swollen from 600,000 to an estimated 1 million, and concrete and breeze-block building sites on the outskirts of Atar have begun to encroach on the sand. Silk Road caravans used to traverse the tabletop mountains that tower above Shabwa's plains in search of frankincense. Today, they have been replaced by oil pipelines and convoys of tankers. Shabwa's governor, Mohammed Saleh Ben Adio, appointed in 2018, has invested millions in beefing up local security forces and infrastructural projects to try to lure foreign oil companies back to the area. However, the aggressions and attacks by the Western-backed Saudi-led coalition against Ansarullah and the innocent Yemeni civilian shows no sign of stopping anytime soon. For ordinary Yemenis, the impact of war can be blunted only so far. The currency, the rial, has lost 2/3 of its value since the Saudi-led attacks against the innocent civilians began and continues to slide, making it harder and harder to put food on the table. A rise in food prices coupled with devastating aid cuts and blockade by the Saudi regime means the prospect of widespread famine is once again on the horizon. According to a study conducted by UN agencies, serious malnutrition in southern Yemen, including Shabwa, has risen to 10% this year and is up 15% among under fives. In a talk market square, everyone is selling but no one is buying. By 11 a.m. local time, glum honey traders and shepherds sit around still waiting to make their first sale of the day. At a CSAM oil shop nearby, owner Khaled is despondent. He says, even if the electricity worked, I've run out of money to pay for it. During Saudi-led attacks, half of the country's healthcare facilities have been destroyed. Hundreds of doctors have martyred. And because of grim economic situation created by the Saudis' attacks and blockade, public sector salaries often go unpaid, putting unsustainable pressure on the hospitals and clinics that remain. At the beginning of 2020, as COVID-19 began to spread from China and around the world, health workers and aid agencies predicted that the virus impact on Yemen's vulnerable population would be catastrophic, forecasting a 90% infection rate. Yet, despite its utter affliction so far, the war-torn country appears to have emerged relatively unscathed by the pandemic, reporting just 2,124 cases and 611 deaths to date. Testing facilities and comprehensive data are almost non-existent, so it is highly unlikely the official statistics reflect the coronavirus' true impact. But according to several doctors and healthcare officials, in Shabwa at least, the virus is not a pressing concern. A gleaming new COVID-19 testing, treatment and quarantine center on the edge of Attock City, regarded as the best facility in the country, hasn't received a single patient since August. Staff in head-to-toe protective gear mill around the state-of-the-art testing machine are disinfecting surfaces for lack of anything better to do during a visit of a group of foreign journalists. The center has conducted nearly 4,000 tests so far, only 90 of which came back positive, and Shabwa province as a whole has recorded 46 deaths. Asked why the number of COVID-19 cases in Yemen appears to be so much lower than elsewhere, despite the absence of social distancing and extra hygiene measures, the center's director, Dr. Hisham Said, says high morale and a population that skews young have kept Yemenis safe from the coronavirus. However, he worries that the growing stigma associated with the disease and the difficulty of travel mean people in need of treatment are just staying home. He says it is very hard to tell what the impact is, adding, people think it's a normal fever. Sometimes they ask me whether coronavirus is all just a big lie. Satellite imagery analysis of graveyards in the southern province of Aden, where COVID-19 appears to have hit hardest, suggests otherwise. A study from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine found that the number of new burials in the area had nearly doubled since the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in April, and there have been 2,100 excess deaths against an expected baseline of about 1,300 by the end of September. Analysis by the medical charity Med Global published in July found that at least 97 Yemeni healthcare workers had already died of the disease, suggesting that the true case load and mortality figure is far higher than recorded. For now, the peak of the coronavirus pandemic in Yemen, or at least its first wave, appears to have subsided, allowing healthcare workers to focus on the country's other urgent health crises. Shabwa's governor, Mohammed Saleh bin Ido, is funding most of the operational costs at Attar General Hospital and spending $2 million on a new hospital complex near the COVID-19 center. Work began on the site in 1994, but the facility was never finished as funding dried up because of war. In 2015, the empty building used as a base by the Ansarullah for a commanding center in order to defend the defenseless Yemenis leading the Saudi-led coalition to bomb it. 5 years later, it has been fully repaired by the Ansarullah movement, and construction workers are installing central air conditioning and lighting systems. Empty corridors smelling of fresh paint await medical equipment that international charities have promised to help provide. The new facility should have 240 beds compared with 140 at Attar General Hospital and will boast dedicated maternity, cardiac and infectious disease wards. A powerful new governor should keep the electricity on for 24 hours a day, allowing monitors and ventilators to function without interruption. Local authorities hope the hospital will come online in early 2021, although many obstacles still stand in the way. Well-trained staff, functioning equipment, and supplies of medicine are never guaranteed because of the Saudi blockade and aggression. The head of pediatrics, Dr. Saleh Al-Khamsi, says, "I lost the little boy last week to dengue fever because we had no antitoxins to give him. I called every hospital in the south, but no one had any. Maybe he could have lived." Adding, "Even if the war ends, I worry that we have already lost a generation."
Around the world with reporters.
Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Kazem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the U.S. should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
"These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities."
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
"As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of the United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights."
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
"Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus," they said,
sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homolezki, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaq is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States. But also, trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal? Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge.